We're here to talk about the work today. And a big part of the work is art, and we love art at RTRFM. It's central to what we do. It's a central part of the book. And growing up, it was also a central part of your life, skipping school to be with your mum at Lee's Visual Art Supplies.
Yeah.
Tell me about these formative years.
Such a beautiful origin story. So my mother, growing up, always was and still is a brilliant visual artist, mostly painter, but also some sculpture and mixed media and basically whatever she wants. We never had the financial situation that would, you know, enable someone to sort of dedicate their life to their art. So she owned and operated this small art supplies shop at a place called the Brisbane Institute of Art, which sounds very fancy, but certainly when we were there, like, you wouldn't even get what we would now refer to as on par with, like, a TAFE qualification. It was very much a kind of, I don't want to minimize the abilities or the aspirations of the people who studied there, but it was the thing that you did after work in the evenings, or the thing that you went to do on the weekend just because you loved it. You wanted to learn and get better at it. And overall, essentially, was, I think, a really beautiful way to first get exposed to the world of visual art, because it was not, like, professionalized. You know, the world of visual art that I have set my novel in is extremely commercialized and professionalized. You know, whether it's the old art world with the antiquities and auction houses, or the new art world with the white wall galleries and the big art fairs. But my origin story of my relationship to visual art is just people doing it because they loved it. I remember I would skip school quite often and stand on an upside down milk crate behind their cash register.
Yeah.
Putting people's art supplies through for them. And to this day, I can smell from hundreds of meters away if I'm walking down the street and there's an art supplies shop nearby because of the terps and the oil paints. And I just love it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's very similar to the work in terms of the passion that the characters have for their art, but it's also a far cry from, I guess, the capital value that is placed on art in the novel. To the book now, I'd love to touch on the title before we really kick things off in earnest. The work refers to a lot of things in the book. How did you land on the name?
So it had a different name for the first about four years of working on this book. It took 5 years in total. And I started out with a very sort of earnest and, like, almost poetic title that was a real, like, unmanageable mouthful. And I also started out, frankly, over 5 years ago now, working on a book that is very different to the one I ended with. You have to let art surprise you sometimes. I'm pretty sure most creatives would say that if you're working on a major project, it could be a book, or it could be a collection of artworks, or an album, like, or a show, whatever it is. If you are letting the work do its organic thing and grow and change with you as a creative, as you grow and change, it will change. And so it came time that we needed a better title. And the thing I love, and how we settled on The Work as a great title for this book, is because it is deliberately ambiguous. And it's very much built into the structure and the skeleton of this novel that it rewards a smart reader who is willing to meet it in the middle. You know, that it's in these alternating chapters, and there are a lot of very deliberate, carefully placed gaps for the reader to fill themselves. And I love that different people are getting so many different things out of the title, The Work.
Yeah, what resonated with me was, I guess, the work that it takes to have a relationship and that kind of work, but then also, you know, the literal work that the main characters are doing, which is the art itself.
In the years of drafting this, in particular in, like, 2019, 2021, I was reading a huge amount of contemporary fiction that we would now very clearly classify as so-called the sad girl novel or sad girl fiction, in which the characters often are just kind of like disenfranchised, disconnected, pretty mopey, pretty ambivalent about whatever their job is. They're in unsatisfying relationships, and they're not particular. They're, you know, for very many and varied valid reasons, they're just apathetic towards, like, a lot of the different parts of their lives.
Yeah.
That I was writing basically against that. That I didn't recognize that in many of my peers. I didn't recognize that in my life, and it was not what I wanted to read any more about, and it wasn't what I wanted to write. And so there was something in the end when the title of the work appeared as an option. I just felt such a pull towards it because it is like such a loaded and active word.
Yes.
Like it is somehow both
active.
A noun and a verb. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a lot in it, which is just goes against what I was frustrated that I kept getting given to read.
Yeah, it just subverts the apathy that comes with those, you know, sad girl novels and the literature that is so mainstream now for, you know, reasons that probably relate to the book, capital and marketing and all of those things. But for me, it was absolutely a verb. It was like, this shit takes work.
Mm.
It takes work. It's a verb. Can you introduce me to Pat and Lally?
I'd be delighted. So Pat is in his late 20s. He's originally from regional Queensland. He got a quite precious scholarship for high school to go to a rich inner city Sydney high school. And that has created a real, you know, rift in his like sort of life growing up. It's like a psychological wound essentially. And he now works for in the old art world at a, you know, arts and antiquities auction house and valuer sort of dealership in Sydney. But he very much does not have the money that all of his peers there do, or indeed his superiors, but he also doesn't feel particularly welcome or comfortable back home because there's just too much difference now between his parents and siblings and himself. And then we have Lally. Lally's in her early 30s. She's a New Yorker. She owns and runs her own independent art gallery in Chelsea. It's full of new contemporary art, sometimes even like experimental art. And they're both very, very ambitious, but I would say Pat's ambition is because he has to be. Financially, he's in a situation of pretty, like, precarity, whereas Lally is ambitious because she wants to be, and it's a huge part of her identity. So it's old art boy meets new art girl.
Yeah, Lally's character in particular was so refreshing to me, and I think one thing the book does really well is totally flip that power imbalance that you often see in literature, which is the man is powerful, he's older, he has some sort of, sexual power over the woman, and that is totally flipped. And I feel like that was deliberate. Can you talk me through your decision to do that?
Definitely. That was one of the other recurring sort of tropes in the so-called sad girl novel, is that in a lot of them, you have a woman in particular, a young woman often, getting fucked badly by a man, in particular an older man, and fucked badly in the sort of wide spectrum of what that might mean.
Yeah.
But from just sort of on, you know, obviously on one end, like horrific sort of criminal level conduct, but on the other end, frankly, just so much underwhelming sex where the woman either can't or just doesn't make clear what her desires are, and the man, and this is obviously super hetero, the man either doesn't want to be it any kind of generous lover or just doesn't really care. And the sex is at best underwhelming and unsatisfying.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I was in my late 20s when I started writing this book. So that's Pat's age. And now that I'm touring it, I'm in my early 30s, which is Lally's age. And I just remember in my late 20s thinking, reading this book after book after book of all this crap sex and thinking, God, it's like, it's got to get better than this.
Yeah.
Really? Like, is this the best our literature can do for us at this time? And I was thinking a lot about what that says about our culture and our society, that it was and continues to be an undeniable trend. You know, it's not every single book, but it is clearly a lot of them where this recurring bad sex and that happens, which is a result of the power dynamic that you just described. And so when I was in the early stages of formulating who these characters would be, there was just this moment where I thought, well, what difference would it make if even in a small age gap, like I imagine Lally and Pat to be maybe 5 years age difference, what difference would it make if she was in her early 30s? And all of a sudden it was just this like light bulb moment where all of these other really exciting dynamics presented themselves, because it means that they approach the relationship that they start forming with different, not only different degrees of self-knowledge and confidence. Like for women, that I have had the pleasure and privilege of knowing in my life, just the confidence and agency and self-awareness and everything from their late 20s to their early 30s is like transformative.
Yeah.
But also they come to the relationship pattern Lally do with different amounts of capital, you know, different actual amounts of sort of money and where they're at in their jobs.
Yeah.
And that's even that slight difference in age going in the opposite direction to what we see in our society and very much in our literature, it just made everything start crackling with something that, like a new, fresh way of asking these questions and interrogating these sort of power dynamics and issues that I was just not seeing that much of. Because what, like, if we get so-called age gap relationships with an older woman, often it will be a much more extreme age gap where it is supposed to kind of make a point about older women or younger men, which is, you know, really valuable, like, great. We should, you know, frankly, have more of that. But I was interested in, well, what does it mean if that gap is only slight? And what a huge difference it makes if it's just not what we keep getting the same thing more and more of.
Yeah. So fucking juicy. I love it. You basically grew up with Pat and Lally. You know, you did mention that you started writing the book and you were Pat's age, now into Lally's age. And this idea started to form around 2018. And this was about the time that Eggshell Skull became a thing. What was going on for you at that time, and what was the catalyst into pivoting into fiction?
Yeah, so I started thinking about the kind of questions and themes and issues that I wanted to explore in this book in late 2018. And then I started seriously writing it in 2019, early that year when I went across to New York again for a research trip for this book. But the questions I was having were essentially about how not just money, but capital in the bigger sense, sort of wealth and intergenerational wealth and real estate and accumulated cash and everything, how capital was affecting art and how capital was affecting love. And in particular, art and love are two things that our society likes to, like, we like to tell ourselves ought to be pure and unaffected by money and capital, you know? And if you even so much as admit or let alone question how money affects love or how money affects art, then you are a bad lover or a bad artist. You're a sellout, you know, and it's dirty. We want those things to somehow remain pure and separate. But what I was seeing in my late 20s was that the only people who benefited from that sort of starving artist mythology were the people with secret trust funds.
Yeah.
The question of which of my friends who had creative tendencies or, you know, some kind of artistic outputs, whatever the form that took, you know, writing, sure, but also friends of mine who were in theatre and performance industries, music, visual art, whatever it was, the ones that basically had creative independence were and artistic means were the ones whose parents had different relationships to real estate. Like it, and I was watching people sort of either quote unquote tap out and have to pursue responsible careers versus the people who could afford to, you know, pay less rent because actually the apartment they're living in is owned by their parents or whatever it is. You know, it just seemed offensive, frankly, to suggest that artists, young creatives, shouldn't be thinking about whether or not their art makes money and about how they need to operate within the market in order to make their work sustainable. And, you know, at the same time, it seemed like a pretty big deal that in your late 20s, a lot of people are either breaking up with their sort of university era partners or kind of locking it down.
Yeah.
And the money conversation gets like heavy and serious.
Absolutely.
Pretty quickly. So those were that was the kind of cluster of murky grey area questions and issues. And I just knew quite early on when I started thinking about how I wanted to answer them that fiction was the way better container to kind of hold those inquiries than nonfiction. Because I think people who pick up a nonfiction book expect to receive an argument. But people who pick up a fiction book are much more willing to sit with a question.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing that I really appreciated with the work was the I guess the tension that arises in families when there is that class or capital divide, or that one person, you know, goes off and kind of strays away from the conventions of the family. Or I know, as you know, coming from a migrant family, it's all about the literal work, and if you don't earn money, have a good job, buy a house, get married, settle down, then you are considered the absolute anomaly, you know. And I think you captured that tension super well. I don't think class is something that Australians generally discuss really well. I think it's still quite taboo.
But it's so interesting and frankly, like, gratifying and relieving to hear you say that about the migrant experience, because I got a lot of pats. What, like, not like, I don't know, inspiration. When I was researching for how I would build the character that is Pat, I read a lot of migrant writing because a recurring theme in that, you know, vast body of literature is that often people feel like they either end up with two homes or no home. And I thought, well, if he has come from a very, very different A, geographic, and B, class background growing up to where he finds himself now as a young professional, am I going to make this person, like, feel at home in both places or at home in neither place?
Yeah.
And ultimately, of course, it's, like, much more compelling and high stakes if he doesn't feel like he's at home in either place.
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a good insight. The work is a piece of art. And I'm wondering how you grappled with then writing this story when it is something that has so much cultural value but is also something that can be packaged and marketed and, you know, something that you're now touring. Did it change the way that you approached the writing process or the book itself?
Okay, two examples, one quite specific and then one kind of wiggly and vague.
Yeah, go for it.
Is that, for example, when I was creating who these two characters would be, I knew I wanted them on opposite sides of the planet for various reasons. I wanted them to be via distance quite a lot. And I knew that I wanted one of them to be set in New York because the art world there is such a, you know, glorious, deranged pressure cooker.
Yeah.
And so I was like, and I knew it would, wanted to have it be a heterosexual relationship because that's those are the questions of gender and power I'm interested in asking. And I knew from the outset that I couldn't make the Australian character the woman. Otherwise, lazy readers and lazy media would just presume or have a juicy time trying to infer autobiographical information about me if I had an Australian woman character in there. So there are, that was probably one of the more specific ways in which I was just aware. I try not to be at the drafting and really creative, exciting, generative stage thinking about the audience, yeah, like publicity stage. Like, those two things shouldn't affect each other very, yeah, much. But at that early stage, like, it did. I'm not, I think it would be naive. It's naive to write fiction in which a character, a main character, very clearly mirrors, like, autobiographical details about an author and not expect to get that kind of questioning. You have, yeah, and it sucks that it does, yeah, but, like, that's the world in which we live. So, you know, I'm not going to try and fix that problem. I'm just going to try and deal with it. But the other kind of more wiggly, big meta thing, I guess, is just that there are so many things about touring that require me to be the exact opposite kind of human being that for the rest of my life makes me good at my job. My job actually is my, like, what makes me good at my job is my ability to sit by myself quietly at a desk for 5 years at a time.
Yeah. And just, it's a long time to be so solitary and to be, yeah, thinking about all these things.
Yeah, and just do the work.
Yeah.
And then the touring part, which is hyper-visible, you know, if you're fortunate, which I very much am, very fortunate, to have a very visible tour. But this is, you know, 0.01% of what the writer's life is. So you just try and, I'm just trying to ride the wave and enjoy it. Because it just, and the thing that you have, that I'm trying to remember is that actually my favorite thing about writing is just being under the hood and doing the work. So the best piece of writing advice I ever received was from Chris Neen, the Brisbane-based author. And they told me to make sure, and this was like 7 years ago, they told me this. Make sure that by the time I was touring one book, I already knew what I was working on next so that the noise wouldn't get to me so much.
Yeah.
And this whole tour, I've just been thinking about the next book. Yeah. And that's what keeps me sane.
Yeah, I hear you there. And thank you for sharing, you know, your thoughts about just having to think about, I guess, the media conversations surrounding the book. I know that as a woman writer and someone in the public eye, that's it's really hard to have to even, you know, think about.
It's a double-edged sword, right?
Like, yeah.
It's so...
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is.
And it's not the kind of thing, it's like not, you know, as my dear friend Bridie says, no whinging.
No whinging.
not complaining about it, but it's hard to, you know, I don't enjoy being in the public eye. Like, I even being the tiny 0.001% famous that I am, I'm like, oh my gosh, it has given me such a much more mammoth sympathy for people who are actually famous. Like, it is really weird and can be if you don't have a really sort of tight-knit crew around you who have always known you, who are like basically offline.
Yeah.
It can get really destabilizing and uncanny kind of.
Yeah.
But the reason anyone is even looking at me is because I have had the absolute privilege of being able to have a platform to share my work.
Mm.
And I'm an artist. Of course I want to share my work.
Yeah.
So like you don't get to pick one and not have the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's it's weird. It's weird.
It's weird. I can only imagine. Yeah. I think I am curious because I know I would struggle. So yeah, it's just so interesting to me. A couple of final wrap up questions. You're in WA for a limited time, but you're heading down to one of my favorite places on earth, Margaret River. Where can people catch you?
I am going to Margaret River this afternoon, evening, for an out-of-season event with the beautiful team at the Margaret River Writers Festival.
Gorgeous.
I have never been there before, but everyone keeps telling me how beautiful
Brie,
it is.
You're going to love it.
Yeah.
You're going to love it. From the limited time I've spent with you, you're going to adore Margaret River.
Yay.
Drink all the wine. Eat all the food.
Yes,
it's going to be
ma'am.
Great.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. There's an order.
yeah. Back here in Perth tomorrow night for a book, for an event with the lovely independent bookstore Open Book, but that one is sold out.
Amazing.
RIP. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry to everyone missed out. Wonderful. And before I do let you go, Brie, you know, success has lots of different metrics in the art world, capital and cultural. And as someone who has just written a wonderful book, which is touring and selling out workshops and talks, what does success look like for you when it comes to the work?
Artistic freedom and integrity. Yeah. The only metric I've ever needed my book to succeed upon, like any of my books, is that they do well enough that I have the freedom to write exactly what I want to write next.
Mm.
And so far they've all done that. So, I think, well, what I know, I'm still in the first decade of this career, which I hope to be able to just do until I die. So I just go book by book and focus on doing the work.
Amazing way to leave it. Thank you so much, Brie, for joining us on RTR.
Thank you, Danny. This has been a blast.